Hello and welcome to the 538 Politics Podcast. I'm Galen Druk. As April comes to an end, the country is entering a new phase of its response to the coronavirus pandemic. Numerous states have begun to reopen some non-essential businesses and activities, and more states are planning to do so soon. The White House's national guidelines for social distancing expire at the end of the day today, which is Thursday. Unsurprisingly, experts have done some thinking about how this next phase ought to go. At the same time, it's also become something of a political issue. So today, we're going to try to cut through the political debates and discuss the data behind how to proceed into this new phase responsibly. And here with me to do that is health security expert Crystal Watson. She's a professor at the Johns Hopkins Center for Health Security and co-authored reports on reopening from Johns Hopkins and the American Enterprise Institute. Thank you for being here with me, Crystal.
Thanks very much, Galen. I'm excited to be here.
Awesome. So as of today, according to a tally from the New York Times, 9 states have partially reopened, and more than a dozen plan to do so in the coming week. Now, that reopening, of course, looks different in each state. But from your observations, are these states generally in a safe position to begin reopening?
Yeah, it doesn't look like they are there yet, for the most part. We've been working hard over the past couple of months to set forth these evidence-based plans for lifting social distancing measures. And in this roadmap to reopening that we've proposed, we think there are 4 phases to the response. Right now, we're in the first phase, slowing the spread, and we want to move into phase 2, which is state-by-state reopening, gradually lifting these social distancing measures. But there really are some data indications of when we can reopen safely, and also capacities that we need to build at the state and local level before we can do that safely. So we need this sustained reduction in daily case numbers. We haven't seen that yet in a lot of these locations. We think we've initially said sustained is 2 weeks at least of daily reductions in case numbers. We also have to have evidence from hospitals that they're not under stress. They're not operating in crisis mode, and they have surge capacity to give if there were to be another surge of cases. And then we also need to see much more widespread testing across the country. We need to be able to test anyone with symptoms at a bare minimum. And we need to lastly scale up our healthcare workforce to identify cases and do contact tracing in order to manage the epidemics going forward. And so in these states, I largely don't see evidence that we've met those 4 criteria yet.
Yeah. So what is the overarching goal of the phase 2 that you've described, where we have all of those things in place, the testing and contact tracing, a general decline in cases, hospital capacity? Is it to eventually stamp out the virus, or is it to simply make sure that hospitals don't exceed their capacity? Like, is it maintain that flattened curve that we were introduced to at the beginning of this crisis?
Right. It really is to maintain that flattened curve. We don't think that we can eliminate this virus from our country altogether, at least not until we have a safe and effective and widespread vaccine. And even then, it may be difficult. So what we really need to do is to manage this on a more case-by-case basis rather than at a population level, which is what we're doing now. And that will allow us to kind of bump along until we have more tools in our toolbox to manage this, which is a vaccine or a therapeutic to reduce the severity of illness. So this phase is going to last us a while, and we'll be able to lift restrictions to some extent if we have these capacities in place, but it's still going to look like a pretty different world until we have a vaccine, I think.
From the perspective of not overwhelming hospitals, I'm curious, I think some states, you know, even New York, where we had a really bad outbreak in New York City, expected a lot more hospitalization than ultimately ended up happening. And so, you know, in a lot of places in the country, the hospitals were never overwhelmed or maybe even never came close. So from the perspective of those parts of the country, is it okay to just kind of implement social distancing but not have a total lockdown, even if these other, you know, tracing capacities aren't in place? I mean, that kind of seems like what some states have already been doing in the states that never shut down to begin with, and even what countries like Sweden are doing, which is if you can find a way to not overwhelm hospitals without being shut down, maybe you don't need the shutdown.
Yeah. So I think We came very close in New York to having hospitals that were pretty overwhelmed. And I don't think we're out of the woods by any means. If we were to lift all measures right now, we would see a big resurgence of this virus in our communities, and we would have hospitals that were overwhelmed. So we do need to continue to keep that in mind and to work towards maintaining a low level of spread of this virus. Your example in Sweden is interesting. It's hard to get the full picture there of what social distancing measures are being put in place right now, but we do see, when you compare to neighboring countries that have done these stay-at-home orders and more of a lockdown approach, Sweden has a much higher case fatality ratio than neighboring countries that have taken more drastic social distancing measures. So their hospitals, on some level, are being overwhelmed in order to drive up that mortality. So we have a lot of deaths that we can avoid by taking these measures. I don't think any state wants to stay under stay-at-home orders longer than we need to, but really, it is this capacity to manage the virus on a case-by-case basis that's going to enable us to do this safely.
Yeah, I just want to linger here because I think this is where the sticking point is for some of this political debate over whether we really need to stay shut down longer or whether we can start opening if hospitals aren't being overrun. I think like the Sweden's argument is this is a marathon. And so you can look at our mortality rate now. And yes, we may be higher than Denmark or Norway. But in the long run, we're going to, you know, this is a tacit argument. They don't say herd immunity explicitly, but they'll right. eventually hit herd immunity. And then, you know, they won't be suffering deaths anymore when other countries still are. And again, as long as kind of hospitals aren't being overrun, which they aren't in a lot of places around the country, why not take that approach?
Because they will be overrun. I think what we're seeing when this case fatality ratio goes up to this extent, it gets into the double digits, it is because patients can't get the care they need, whether it's from COVID directly or this is not counted in the COVID deaths, but other deaths are occurring unnecessarily because people can't get access to care. So cases will go up, deaths will skyrocket if we can't protect hospitals and protect vulnerable people at home. What we're seeing right now in the U.S. is largely a result of the drastic social distancing measures we've all been willing to put in place for the last 6 or 8 weeks. So we don't know another world yet where we don't have those measures in place. But I think biologically, it makes sense. And for public health officials, it makes sense that if we remove those protections, we are going to see cases go up and we will see hospitals become overwhelmed.
So at this point, is that what you're expecting to happen 2 to 3 weeks down the line from right now, now that all of these states are starting to open up?
I think to some extent. It's not uniform, though, because there are people in these locations who may not be willing to go out yet because they want to continue to protect themselves. People are going to have different behaviors now. They're wearing masks and practicing social distancing even when they're out in public. And businesses are not going to uniformly open up just because they can. So I think we will still see some protection there, but I do expect to see an uptick in cases in those locations.
Do you think ultimately that idea that at the end of both curves, the peaked curve and the more shallow curve, the same mm-hmm. percentage of Americans have gotten the virus? Or do you think that there is some world in which we all mitigate this so heavily to the point that not 40 to 80% of Americans have gotten it by the time we have a vaccine?
I mean, I think there's the possibility that we have a world where we have a vaccine soon enough that not as many people have gotten sick by the time we reach that point. That's one reason to do this. The other reason is we're protecting particularly vulnerable people who would otherwise get sick and die from this disease by practicing these different social distancing measures and implementing these capacities at the public health level to track and isolate and quarantine contacts. So the curves will look different. Whether we reach the same kind of population level number of infections is up in the air, but I'm hopeful that we can have a vaccine before we get to that level. If we were just to let this go and burn through our population We would see many more people get sick, but also many more people die because we're not protecting those who are the most vulnerable in our communities.
There's been some debate about once you start to reopen, who are the people who take part in the economy or in public life? Is there any argument to allowing less vulnerable parts of the population and those people who already have the antibodies for the virus to kind of let them go out into the world and get herd immunity, say, you know, younger or healthy people, even if you maintain strict mitigation measures for more vulnerable populations? Or is that just not possible?
So I think some of that is valid. We do want to protect more vulnerable people who have clear risk factors for severe disease with COVID-19. We want them to socially isolate more. And we know people are going to have to go out and into the world and do their jobs and continue to live. So younger and healthier people inevitably will do that. But we can't always predict who will become severely ill and die from this disease. There are lots of examples of very young, healthy people who you otherwise would think would do fine who have died. So it's not harmless to go out and do this. So everyone needs to protect themselves to some level. But we do need to shelter the people who are especially vulnerable that we know will have a much harder time with this.
Yeah. Okay. Once we have the four steps that you mentioned in place, which is, to repeat them, I think it's having enough testing, having hospital capacity, being able to trace the contacts of anybody who does test positive, and then a sustained reduction in cases for those 2 weeks. Are we still making some kind of societal decision that, yes, there will be risks to reopening and the cases will probably increase or there will be more spread, but that, you know, it's kind of worth it because the alternative is keeping everybody locked down for months on end? Is that still a kind of trade-off right that politicians and society are making?
Absolutely. It's always going to be a trade-off. We can't reduce risk here to zero. It's not possible. We can mitigate risk to a great extent by following the numbers here and knowing when it's safer to go back to work and also building up these capacities in order to manage this on a more case-based level. But yeah, we will have to make some decisions as a society about what type of risk and what level of risk we're willing to accept. I want to accept a lower level of risk, and that's why I think putting these contact tracing capacities in place is really important because it really is the tool we have to do that, to reduce that risk.
Is the public health community generally in agreement on this, what the balance of risk should be? Is there anybody who argues that we should stay locked down until there's just a vaccine? Is there anybody in the public health community that, you know, is supporting Sweden's approach?
Yeah, I don't think we're in uniform agreement about all of this. I do think we're realistic as public health professionals that we all have to live our lives too. We can't stay quarantined at home forever. So there are trade-offs here. I think most of us agree that we need to do anything we can from the public health perspective to make this less risky to open up. But this is a big shift in mindset, actually, for public health when it comes to a respiratory pandemic like this. We've been looking at influenza as an example because it's the example that we have from our recent past. And for flu, not necessarily a pandemic, but a seasonal flu, we test more often at the beginning of a season to understand where the virus is spreading. And then we do some case identification and contact tracing. But largely, we rely on other tools. We rely on a vaccine. We rely on antivirals to help reduce illness from influenza in a season. And so we've never done this type of comprehensive case finding and contact tracing for this type of an infectious disease emergency where it's widespread across our country. So it is a shift in mindset, even for public health, to do this. But I do think it's possible. We've seen it in other parts of the world, and it has been successful. So I feel like we can't abdicate our responsibility to do that in public health. If we can raise a workforce to do this, we should.
How long do you think it will take for states to reach those four criteria that you've set out and that your colleagues set out in these reports?
It's going to be variable across the country, obviously. this is more like hundreds of small epidemics rather than a national epidemic. So it will have to be evaluated on a case-by-case basis. But we're seeing cases start to come down in places like New York and California and the West Coast. So we're seeing that that possibly will be met in the next few weeks. We are also seeing hospitals that are not under strain in those places. And so that criteria can also be met soon. Widespread testing, we're ramping up testing. I think within the next month or two, we may have enough testing. There's a lot of bottlenecks in that still, and it's not entirely clear why testing is so held up still. But I do think there's a path to get there. And then scaling up the public health workforce, we're seeing in a number of locations, Massachusetts, New York, California has a plan to do this, and there are plans being released every day. Hiring, I think, is going to be the rate limiting step there. Training can happen pretty quickly within a matter of a week or so. So there is nothing in this that makes me think we can't get there in the next couple of months and do this more safely. I really think that every state that commits to this, it is possible to make it happen.
In all of this, and I think this has come up a lot in the political part of this debate, how do public health experts weigh the costs of a stay-at-home order to the public health?
Yeah, that's a good question, and it's a complicated issue because obviously we're seeing dramatic decreases in people presenting to healthcare for things like heart attacks. And so we know that heart attacks are still continuing to occur. They're just not getting to a hospital in many cases, either because the capacity isn't there, but more people, I think, are more reluctant to go and seek care. So that's just one example of the ancillary health impacts of this stay-at-home order. And so I do think it's something that we need to pay close attention to, and it should weigh heavily into our calculus of when we lift these social distancing measures, for sure.
I want to talk a little bit more about what phase two, this reopening phase, once you've met these targets, looks like. But first, today's podcast is brought to you by ZipRecruiter. During this time of change, ZipRecruiter's focus hasn't changed. They're still doing what they've always done, helping people find work and helping businesses find the right people for their open roles. If you're looking for a job, ZipRecruiter is working with you to find the right job faster. They're dedicated to helping you get hired, from caretaking to delivering food and goods to building medical facilities, supplying protective equipment, and so much more. In fact, ZipRecruiter's app will send you up-to-date job openings so you can be the first one to apply. And if you're actively hiring, ZipRecruiter will invite candidates to apply to your most urgent roles, making it faster and easier to reach the people you need. By connecting people who need jobs and companies that need people, ZipRecruiter is helping everyone work together. Go to ZipRecruiter.com/work together. Again, that's ZipRecruiter.com/work together. We're back, and you laid out these four criteria that we've been discussing as kind of prerequisites to opening, an opening that doesn't eliminate all risk, but kind of keeps the spread managed to a point where hospitals are not overwhelmed. Mm-hmm. Why these four specific criteria and not something else? You know, how did you and your colleagues come to the conclusion that these were the four criteria that you needed?
Right. Sometimes they're proxies for other things. The sustained reductions in daily case numbers, we need to have cases go down to a level where they are manageable on a case-by-case basis. So we needed an indicator of that. And so the daily reduction in case numbers shows us that at least the we're past the peak of the curve in a specific location, and we're coming down, and it will be more manageable. We know severe illness and overwhelmed healthcare capacity has a big impact on how these epidemics play out. So that is key here. We need the main purpose of flattening the curve was to protect hospitals. And so we need to make sure that they're not feeling overwhelmed before we lift social distancing measures, and that they're ready to face other surges of cases if they do occur. So we need some indicators within that realm. We know that's critically important. And widespread testing, that is how we understand where this virus is. We haven't gotten there yet in this country, and other countries have. So we know that it's important to identify in cases. We can do contact tracing without a positive test. We can have a presumptive positive individual and still ask them to isolate at home and ask them for their contacts and get those contacts to quarantine. But it sure makes it a lot easier. It makes it easier for public health to do population level surveillance to understand where these epidemics are going, because we need to be careful once we lift these social distancing measures. We need to have early indication of a surge of cases and growing community spread that's unrecognized for this disease. And then the public health workforce, we've just come to the realization that this is really the primary tool that we have to control this virus. If we can identify as many people as possible and break chains of transmission between their contacts and the next person that contact may meet up with, that is how we ultimately control this in a much more manageable way until we have a vaccine.
Testing and tracing and building up that tracing workforce seems like the next big lift for government, state-level government, local government. And it, again, could, you know, well become a political issue because not everybody may want to download an app on their phone that tracks who they've been in contact with. And maybe not everybody will want to self-isolate once they have been selected by these public health workers as somebody who's been in contact with somebody who had COVID-19. How do you manage the different civil liberty issues that are brought up in contact tracing?
Sure. So traditional contact tracing, it involves technology more to collect data, collect information from cases and contacts and use that for public health to help support those people when they need to isolate or quarantine at home. But this new idea of adding digital contact tracing tools to this approach, it really is new. It's been implemented recently in other parts of the world, and we're exploring implementing it here now. We can do contact tracing without those tools, and public health does this all the time with sexually transmitted infections like HIV, measles, the measles outbreak that happened last year in New York State. That was brought under control through very stringent case identification and contact tracing. So we can do that without these tools. So people who have objections to the privacy issues surrounding the digital technologies, public health is still going to work on this. And public health is also very good at keeping that information private, handling sensitive information from individuals who have other diseases. So we know how to do this. With the digital tools, I do think there's a balance to be struck here, and we need to have some conversations around what privacy risks we're willing to accept in order to better enable public health to do their job here and control the virus. So it's going to be a balance, and it probably will take some more discussion in our country before we're ready to embrace a digital tool like that.
One suggestion I've heard is that once people have been identified to self-isolate, we may not have, or we may not want, some people in amongst the American public, the enforcement tools to keep people quarantined in their homes like they have in China, for example. So one suggestion I've heard is that people should be paid to self-isolate if they have been detected by the contact tracers as somebody who should do that. Is that frequently used in public health? Is this a new idea? Have we done this before?
I think it's a pretty new idea. I don't think it's out of the realm of possibility. In fact, there's some legislation being introduced to Congress right now that proposes a large amount of funding for this. I think it was $45 billion proposed to support testing and contact tracing. And a majority of that funding would go to actually paying people to stay home if they're either if they have the virus and are sick and need to isolate, or if they're a contact and need to quarantine for 2 weeks. So I think these proposals are out there. And frankly, I think that it would be a good thing to better enable people to stay home and protect their communities and their loved ones in addition to themselves.
Apart from the mechanics of getting to phase two, what does phase two look like? Will I be, you know, flying to Florida or whatever to go on vacation? Will I be eating at restaurants? What can the public expect from phase two?
I think phase two is going to be It will be incremental. At first, it's probably going to look a lot like things look for us right now. While you may be going out a little bit more, people will still be wearing face coverings or masks. They will be social distancing to a large extent. The operations of businesses is going to look pretty different to enable social distancing, protect their employees as well as their customers. So I think we'll see a slight difference when we first start to lift these stay-at-home orders. I think the last things to come back will probably be large gatherings. I don't think we'll probably see stadiums full of people for quite some time, because those are big opportunities for viral transmission when we get lots of people in enclosed spaces together. So there's going to be some nuance in between there, and some probably experimentation of what measures we lift. And we need to watch to see what effect that has on epidemics and be ready to reimpose some social distancing measures if need be.
So it's a little bit of like a sticking your toe in the water and waiting 2 to 3 weeks, seeing what happens, and like sticking your whole foot in the water kind of thing.
Yeah, I think that's the prudent way to go, because we don't have enough data to know what these individual social distancing measures really do to the epidemic. And so I think that incremental approach where we systematically release one piece of social distancing and then wait and see what that does, I think that's the good way to go.
And so to clarify here, what's happening in a lot of states is they're going into this slow reopening process, meaning business operations are looking very different. People are still maybe wearing facial coverings or just generally social distancing, but they're not doing the like population scale testing and tracing. So that latter part may not be there, but they're still like, they're not going back to normal.
Not going back to normal. The order in which they open is a little bit interesting, and in some places it may not be as evidence driven as it will be in others. So we'll see what the differences are there when in the order in which and the extent to which these things are reopened.
We say this a lot in questions of democracy and politics, that the states are almost like laboratories for different democratic ideas. Is this kind of how the public health community is now viewing what America is doing? All different states are trying all different things, and you're going to learn what it all looks like?
Yeah, I mean, I don't think we want it to be a laboratory, but I do think we're going to watch carefully, just as we've looked at other countries to see what they're doing. The example of Sweden, we've kept a close eye on that and the differences between Sweden and other countries. So I think we will do that here in the U.S. as well. I will continue to advocate for building these capacities and using this data-driven approach to reopening, but we need to see how this goes in different places as different approaches are used.
All right. So your proposal that you laid out has four phases. Phase one is the shutdown. Phase two is the slow reopening once we have all of those systems in place. What's phase three?
So phase three is establishing immune protection for our populations and lifting social distancing more fully. This is hopefully we will have a safe and effective vaccine that's available on a wide enough scale that we can start immunizing people broadly. That is the gold standard. That's what we want to see. But it would also be more possible to open more fully if we have a good medical countermeasure, a therapeutic that could be used for prophylaxis to prevent people from getting sick if taken on a regular basis, or to reduce the severity of illness significantly if someone does get sick. So those tools will let us lift social distancing measures even more. Maybe not completely if we don't have a vaccine, but definitely more than we will be able to in phase two.
What are the timelines for those?
So the mantra for the vaccine has been 12 to 18 months from the beginning of work on that. I know there is some optimism that there may be a vaccine that could become available starting in the fall. I think that's optimistic, but I'm happy to see the data start to come out on that first vaccine. Therapeutics, we got some good news yesterday that one of the clinical trials with remdesivir is looking positive, that there was an impact in reducing the severity and the length of illness for some people. But then also there was some effect on reducing deaths, although that wasn't statistically significant in this study. But I think overall the news is good with that drug. And so we'll start to see more studies come out on that in the near future and might be able to get that into use if it still continues to look good in the next couple of months.
What is the chance, do you think, that we hit population level immunity before there is a vaccine or robust therapies for dealing with it?
I think it's unlikely. Our experience with pandemics in the past, they tend to be on a 18-month to 2-year time scale. And so with the addition of these social distancing measures and hopefully the measures we'll take through public health to do contact tracing, we're going to flatten that curve. So I don't think that it's likely we'll reach herd immunity by that point. I think we'll have a vaccine in time to make some sort of a difference here if the research continues to go the way it's going.
So, all right, phase 4 looks towards the future, right? What is phase 4?
Right. It's something nobody wants to talk about right now, but rebuilding our readiness for the next pandemic. Unfortunately, this is not the worst case scenario that my colleagues and I have thought about, this COVID-19 pandemic. We have seen viruses emerge that are much more deadly than this one. So we really do have to take the lessons that we're learning from this response, where we've fallen down, and some good highlights as well, and really implement a better approach to preparedness in the future. This will mean focusing more on our public health capacities, our hospital capacities, and increasing our ability to research and develop a vaccine or a therapeutic much more rapidly even than we're doing now, which is the fastest we've ever gone with these things. So we do need to look to the future eventually.
This is a massive question that is going to be answered in many different ways by many different people, many of them with political motives. But why weren't we prepared for this?
So I've been doing this research for a long time. I sometimes feel like we're shouting into the wind. It's a hard thing to envision a moderate to severe pandemic. It feels intractable and has felt intractable. And so I think a lot of our work has been preparing for less severe events, for one thing. We also have this kind of cycle of panic and neglect in public health, where we have an emergency, we have an emerging infectious disease, and we throw money at it, we do the work to respond, but then people quickly forget that what that response took. And so we need to avoid that with this response. I think the world has taken notice now of what an infectious disease can do, not just in terms of our health, but in terms of our economy and our way of living. So hopefully this will galvanize a lot more work going forward.
The next time this happens, God forbid, I hope it's not during any of our lifetimes. I hope it's never again, but, you know, granted, that seems unlikely. What was the right thing to do? Was it to just shut down as soon as word came out from China that this, you know, respiratory virus was spreading? A perfect A+, you know, Johns Hopkins School of Public Health response to this pandemic. What did it look like?
Yeah. So I think a lot of us are reluctant to say we need to shut down completely, because I think there are a lot of other downstream implications to that. But what we can do really from public health is to do better surveillance, better testing, and better case management. So I think doing these immune assays early on in an emergence like this to try and understand better how a virus is spreading in the community and understand what the case fatality ratio really is earlier on will help us make better decisions. Testing, developing tests more quickly and testing ubiquitously. In this country, we were at the beginning of this, we were only testing travelers from China who had severe enough illness to be hospitalized. So we were missing all kinds of other people coming into the country from China or elsewhere who were sick, symptomatic, and spreading the disease in the community because we weren't bothering to test. So that is going to be one huge component of our response next time.
So is my sense correct that in an ideal world, phase two is kind of the phase that you go to first and stick with the whole time and never end up having to shut down if you have all of those systems amped up and ready to go?
Absolutely. That is the ideal. Some countries were able to accomplish that more fully than we were. So yeah, we don't want this ever to happen again where we have a virus that is out of control, spreading in an unrecognized way throughout our communities. I think that is what we need to avoid next time.
All right. Well, this has been really informative for me and hopefully for our listeners as well. So thank you so much for joining me today.
Thanks a lot, Kaylin.
Crystal Watson is a professor at the Johns Hopkins Center for Health Security and co-authored reports on reopening from Johns Hopkins and the American Enterprise Institute. My name is Galen Druk. Tony Chow is in the virtual control room. You can get in touch by emailing us at podcasts@538.com. You can also, of course, tweet at us with questions or comments. If you're a fan of the show, leave us a rating or review in the Apple Podcast Store or tell someone about us. You can also find 538 on YouTube. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you soon.